From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Suddenly, there's a new buzz around old rules for social behavior. Young people signing up for classes to learn the manners that their parents let slide. Books and etiquette schools teaching everything from how to select silverware to how to sign your email. Whether it's nostalgia, new wave elitism, or a new embrace of simple courtesy, etiquette is back on the radar screen of American culture. In an era of road rage, telemarketing, and spam, that might be a good thing. Or it might be insecurity talking. Americans uncertain how to politely be themselves. The 1960s saw the rise of a new social honesty, of authenticity over gentility, diversity over uniformity. If etiquette is back to stay, how does it reflect those values? Can it? This hour On Point, the new buzz over manners. You can join the conversation. Is it high time we buffed up our manners? And what's the evidence that a polish is required? How do you interpret Americans' new interest in etiquette in old-fashioned manners? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, and I should say, please call us. Joining me now from Fort Pierce, Florida, is Jacqueline Whitmore, founder and director of the Protocol School of Palm Beach, where she teaches the rules of business and social etiquette to everyone from college students to CEOs. Jacqueline Whitmore, thanks for being with us.
You're quite welcome. Thank you.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Jack, my good man, wonderful to have you here.
My felicitations to you, sir, and to your guest as well, indeed.
All right. We're going to have fun, but we're also going to figure out what's going on here. And, Jacqueline, we really hope that you will help us. We understand that people in your neck of the woods are seeing a lot more interest from Americans in etiquette and good manners. Tell us about that. What's the evidence of the interest?
After 9/11, I experienced a 50% increase in my company. I have a company called the Protocol School of Palm Beach, and I teach executives the finer points of business etiquette. And I started going all over the country teaching executives simple things like networking skills, handshaking, eye contact, dining skills, and techno etiquette. Cell phones are everywhere. So it's a booming business.
Why suddenly after 9/11? Terrorists blow up the Twin Towers and suddenly people want to have good manners? Do you draw a connection between those two things?
No, not at all. I think that after 9/11, competition became so fierce that companies were looking for small nuances, small ways to get ahead. And etiquette is one of the most powerful business tools that most people don't even consider using, but it is so essential to creating relationships.
Now we know you're strong on this theme. You've got the new book out, Business Class, Etiquette Essentials for Success at Work. So tell us, you're not just selling a book. You're really seeing executives who feel at a loss when it comes to how to behave socially?
What I find is executives are telling me they're lacking self-confidence in social and business situations. For example, if you get a promotion, you have to go to many parties and many dinners, and you're sitting there with VIPs and sometimes dignitaries and luminaries, and you have three forks on the left side and four glasses on the right side. Which glass do you use first? So they get confused and they really just want a little bit more polish. Many of these executives grew up with a foundation, and some of them didn't grow up with any manners at all. I call it the McManners generation.
Okay, here's where my eyebrow begins to cock. I mean, it's one thing to know how to shake hands and look someone else courteously in the eye when you greet them. It's kind of incredible to think that people need training in that. When it comes to the famous four forks, is that really so important to good manners, Jacqueline?
When I wrote Business Class, I asked the executives, I interviewed 50 of what I thought were the most polished and professional CEOs in the country, and I said, what is your pet peeve when it comes to dining? And it wasn't about which fork to use. It was about looking at a person in the eye and watching them talk with food in their mouth. That was the biggest pet peeve. And we're seeing men and women who make $400,000, $500,000, $600,000 a year stabbing their meat like a wild beast. And those are the people who don't feel like they need training, but their boss sees that they do, so they call me.
So what do you think, I mean, never mind people making $400,000, $500,000, and $600,000, good for them, and of course, they're listening, but there's a lot of people making a tenth of that or less. Do you see a general decline in American manners in recent decades? And if you do, Jacqueline, why do you think that happened?
I do see a decline, and there are three factors. Number one, both parents are working, so the children growing up now don't get to sit down at Sunday dinners or sit down with their family at any dinners. They grew up on fast food. And what I also find is the marketplace is extremely multicultural. So the way you deal with someone who is born in the USA isn't necessarily the way you would do business with someone in Japan or, let's say, in Italy. So those are the two big factors. And the third biggest factor is the fact that we are surrounded by technology, more specifically, email, cell phones, fax machines, and telephones, and people are confused. We don't have that face-to-face interaction that we once had. So you're right. It's not just the upper crust that are taking these etiquette classes. I teach at 10 universities, and the college students are hungry for this information.
And they really don't know the simple things like, chewing with your mouth closed and shake hands firmly?
They don't. They're very confused. In fact, I live in South Florida. We have a large Latin community here. We don't know whether to kiss, hug, or shake hands. There's a big confusion. And the other point I'd like to make is women have changed the face of etiquette in the workplace. Women don't know whether to stand to shake hands. Women don't know whether, and I'm not talking about all women, I'm just talking about certain women that I've worked with. They're not sure whether they should shake a man's hand firmly. Men don't know whether they should shake a woman's hand firmly. There's a lot of confusion.
Okay, Jack Beatty, jump in here with us, if I may ask you to do so, sir. I'm hearing all this. On the one hand, who wouldn't like a more gracious society where people are kind and considerate to one another? On the other hand, I can't help remembering a time when some high forms of etiquette did seem like a kind of genteel tyranny and a time when we were glad to escape them. What do you think is going on here, Jack?
Well, I think we're having a hard time reconciling that as it were, cultural imperative toward authenticity that comes out of the 1960s, the idea that you unmask all these social forms, and what you really see is a kind of pantomime, people pretending that something is true when it isn't true. You know, there's a great moment in Emma, Jane Austen's novel, where they go on a picnic, and there's a woman there, an addlepate, and she's being addlepated. She's just chattering on. And Emma puts her down, actually confronts her with who she really is. And Mr. Knightley takes her aside and said, "You just hurt her." And Emma said, "No, I told her the truth." Well, there it is, you see.
Yes.
She told her the truth. She's invoking the standard of authenticity and truthfulness, and Mr. Knightley is saying, what does that mean against this woman's feelings? Of course she's an addlepate. We all know that. We must accept that. You've hurt her gratuitously. So there's the conflict. You know, it's false, Emma is saying, and Mr. Knightley is saying, no, it's socially right.
So when you hear Jacqueline talking about Americans running to these courses, Jack, do you see them looking for a beautiful balance between those things, or, as Jacqueline kind of suggests, looking for a buck by polishing up their sort of corporate, manners persona?
Well, I think the latter. I mean, manners are classy. You know, a person has class who has manners, and you can see it in people who are born wealthy and born with a certain civility. I remember the exquisite manners of the first President Bush. I mean, he wrote personal notes to people. He was always just very gracious to anyone who met him, and that was the mark of class. And, you know, everybody wants class, and I think people who can, you know, use it in their living. But beyond the issue of class, there's just the issue of treating people as you would want them to treat you.
Oh, always this balance. I'm looking here. A lot of people have talked about etiquette and manners over time. Emily Post, of course, very famously said, manners are a sensitive awareness of the feelings of others. If you have that awareness, you have good manners, no matter what fork you use. And then, of course, there's the wonderful Dorothy Parker, Jack, those who have mastered etiquette, who are entirely impeccable. impeccably right would seem to arrive at a point of exquisite dullness. We don't want to go there. Jacqueline, do you find people picking this up? Are they becoming dull by being perfectly mannered, or are they becoming more considerate human beings?
I think that it's all about authenticity. I think it's not being fake. It's not being stuffy. It's being genuine. It's being who you are. If you decide that you're going to be someone you aren't, then you could become dull. But manners or etiquette is knowing how to treat others. It's that awareness that's so important. And I just want to interject that I believe money can't buy manners. We are now faced with the nouveau riche who... some of their manners are deplorable.
Oh, good heavens.
And so my job is to take what they already have and to help bring out the best in them. And it's an awareness, just being aware of others around you and how you treat others.
But do you feel like you're fighting back against the legacy of the 60s, against sort of cultural freedom and let it all hang out?
No, I don't see it as a fight at all. I see it more as a challenge. I'm dealing with so many different people on so many different levels. Everyone's needs are different.
You are perfectly mannered. There's a lot more we want to hear and more people we're going to hear from. Jacqueline Whitmore, please stick with us. We're talking this hour about manners, about etiquette, and the surprising new American interest in buffing up our behavior. Listeners, you can join us. Has the etiquette bug bitten you? Do you wish it would bite somebody else, but you're too polite to say so? Are we in need of a resurgence of manners? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about manners, about etiquette, and the surprising new American interest in rules of behavior. You can join us. Have Americans become too casual, too self-centered, too thoughtless, or have we just dared to be more authentic, more honest? Are you ready for more etiquette? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jack Beatty's with us this hour. We've been joined from Fort Pierce, Florida, by Jacqueline Whitmore. She is founder and director of the Protocol School of Palm Beach, author of Business Class, Etiquette Essentials for Success at Work. We're joined right now from Washington by Letitia Baldridge. She's been around. First female executive at Tiffany & Co. Was in the Foreign Service, special assistant to Ambassador David Bruce in Paris and Ambassador Claire Booth Luce in Rome. She was former social secretary to Jackie Kennedy, and you don't get much classier title than that. She's author of New Manners for New Times, founder of Letitia Baldridge Enterprises. Letitia Baldridge, thanks so much for being with us.
It's great to be with you. If I may call you Tom?
You may. You may. May I call you Letitia?
Yes, Letitia or Tish.
Letitia.
Either one will
okay.
do.
Okay. You've been watching this for a long time. I see here you are a graduate of Miss Porter's School in Farmington, Connecticut. What's your sense of the arc of American manners over the, 50 years you've been watching it?
I have been observing them for over 50 years, and I've seen them going down, down, down recently. I think it's more a question of not caring, of selfishness, and that is because children are not taught all these wonderful things at home by their parents who sit down with them and say, wasn't that a nice thing to do? And look at that young man, what a good sport he is. All of these things which help shape a child's mind. So manners are very important. It's character, and I never use the word etiquette because etiquette to some people is very fancy. It's the frosting on the cake.
Mm-hmm.
It's when you stand up, when you sit down, who goes first. Well, that's very important, but manners are the way you treat another human being. It's the way you come out of your apartment in the morning and say hello to everybody you see, give them a smile because cheers them up, the way you're nice to the people who serve you, whether it's in a restaurant or getting your car out of the garage. It doesn't matter. It's how you relate to other human beings, and that's why it's so basic. And it is not frivolous, and it is not hoity-toity. It's very real.
But, you know, we had this American debate for people of a certain age, probably coming out of the 60s, about, at some level, whether etiquette or even manners were imprisoning or liberating, and for a while there, they were put in the imprisoning category.
Listen, that's what makes the world run. Efficiency, self-discipline. Hey, those two words are something that we don't even hear anymore. But that's what makes the society work. That's why we get together and we interact. And if we interact nicely, then it all works and things get done. Productivity rises. Teamsmanship. It's something that we should teach a child when he or she is 4 years old, the way they act on the playground. You'll get farther ahead. Your team will win if you all work together and you stop crying and complaining that you don't get the ball often enough. Whatever it is, if we all work together, we're going to accomplish great things. And if we do it nicely, it's a nice atmosphere. It's a nice environment. Mm. And so we've got to be kind. And I've been working on etiquette all my life, going to fancy dinners and arranging White House functions. I mean, you can't get any fancier than that.
No, you can't.
But underneath it all is the fact that the president and Mrs. Kennedy were very warm, hospitable people. They made everybody feel good. And that's what we have to do. We have such a tough civilization. We want to feel good every once in a while. Mm. That's why manners are important.
And yet we have all these perspectives on manners. I'm looking here. Let's see. We've got the aphorist Mason Cooley says, good manners protect the privileged but leave the unprivileged more vulnerable. We've got Robert Heinlein says an armed society is a polite society. Manners are good when one may have to back up his acts with his life. And then, of course, there's Humphrey Bogart. I don't mind if you don't like my manners. I don't like them myself. They're pretty bad. I grieve over them on long winter evenings. He doesn't give a hoot, Letitia.
He did give a hoot. He was very nice to people. Everybody on the set loved Humphrey Bogart. I've heard that many times. No, I'll tell you, if you're basically a kind person, you're going to have good manners. And if you open your eyes wide and observe, you're going to have good manners. Many of the people who were polished executives, chairmen of great corporations, grew up in humble surroundings, but they simply opened their eyes and realized, hey, she did that and she made everybody feel good. He did that. Everybody's smiling. And that's how you learn. You teach a kid that, and they suddenly start to realize that's life.
We've got a lot of callers patiently, politely maybe, waiting to join us. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Christina's calling from Burlington, Vermont. Good morning, Christina.
Hello, and I have to say hooray for Ms. Baldridge. Thank you. You've just said so many of the things that I've been dying to say.
Well, good for you.
It is. I have a very good friend of mine. I mean, I'm just 41, which, you know, is probably about
You're a baby.
Yeah, where etiquette really started to leave. But a friend of mine, you know, we've been friends since kindergarten. Our feeling is that everything went to hell in a handbasket when hats and gloves went out. And it isn't the artifice of the clothing, but it's simply a way. You know, when we were raised, you know, you didn't call other adults by their first names. You were waited until you were told that you could or asked to.
Mm.
You know, you didn't.
That's right.
There were certain things, and it just. You see now, I mean, you'll go into restaurants that aren't even necessarily appropriate for children. They're out well past their bedtime at 9 in the evening. They're walking around on the tables, and parents are, you know, applauding them and celebrating.
But Christina, if I may, hats and gloves, I mean, don't you remember a time when women in particular might be walking prisoners of a kind of etiquette that required a certain length of glove or a certain hat in a certain setting? Isn't there a dungeon cell there, too?
No, there are still, for people who care about fashion, there are still fashion strictures. You know, I was raised in Long Island. I was raised that if you went into New York City, you dressed. You looked nice.
Yeah.
You at least took the time to make an effort to look decent. it doesn't mean that you have to have on, you know, the perfect suit and the perfect hat and the perfect, but you at least put some effort into it. I mean, I can go into the city now in jeans. It's a struggle. But, I mean, you know, the far swing of it is that I happened to be in California when President Reagan died and went to go and view the body at the Reagan Library.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, went with somebody on a motorcycle to get through the traffic, so dressed as appropriately as I could, considering I was going to be on a motorcycle. But there was a gentleman behind me, very overweight, which didn't help the picture, but in shorts and a tank top with a beer logo on it.
To see Ronald Reagan's...
Ronald Reagan, and there was a lot of that. And it's not... there comes a point where you don't have to be confined to something, you know, you don't have to go into morning dress, and you don't have to do very specific things, but I think we have lost all ability to have any sense of appropriateness, either with children and how they're taught, and how they're, you know, how they're taught to behave out in public, that it's not free rein all the time, with, you know, what's appropriate to wear when. I mean, it's...
Oh, it's just a tragedy right across the board. Christina, I'm facetious, but you put a lot on the table there, and I thank you for calling in with it. Jack, I want to get, if I may put this so crudely, a gut check from you here. I mean, Christina's saying bring back hats and gloves, and more than that, she's saying bring back a sense of propriety, manners. I mean, I assume or would like to a kind of baseline of good manners, but when things get too fancy, schmancy, it can look like a tyranny if it gets in the way of honesty, efficiency, utility, and sometimes even in the way of kindness. Letitia, I'll ask you about that. But then I wonder, mm-hmm. Jack, who has time? Who wants it?
Who wants good manners?
Well, if it gets too hoity-toity.
Yes, indeed. I mean, it seems to me that manners as a social proposition really relate to civility, which is how we behave in public, which is how we behave as political people, too. And it's the decline in civility more than manners that bothers me. Manners are part of it, but civility is something larger. It's hearing the other person out. It's responding to the other person's argument. It's not assuming you've taped them. Oh, I know, you're a conservative. I know, you're a liberal. All that, or it's even worse, it's ascribing bad motives to people. In other words, their arguments don't really convey their motivations. They're screens. Well, I know what you're really up to. All of that poisons civility, the well of our common life. And that part of manners, the sort of social political part, that part I think is fraying, and that's much more serious than the. Although I agree that it's nice to have, you know, manners.
But
it's nice to have decent appearance.
Can you have civility without manners, Jack?
Well, I suppose you can, but really it helps. Let me give you an example. Walter Dellinger was Solicitor General under Clinton. But he was in private practice earlier, and he was at the Supreme Court in a case against John Roberts, who was representing the Bush Justice Department. He was at his office one day when he got a call from John Roberts at Justice, who said, "Walter, I just want to tell you, you have won your case. Congratulations."
Mm.
Now, that is civility, and that, of course, tells us a lot about John Roberts,
yes,
too.
It does.
That's both good manners and civility.
In one phone call, Jacqueline Whitmore, you've been very politely waiting there. What do you make of this formula that Jack puts out? Civility, manners, etiquette, are they all required? Is there a kind of civility that goes beyond fine points of etiquette? Can people be sort of naturally well-mannered, naturally civil?
That's a very good question, and certainly one for debate. I truly believe that manners and civility go hand in hand, and you can't really have one without the other. But I also agree with Mr. Beatty that I believe that civility is frayed in this day and time, and that's why there's been so much written about it lately. But I do believe that we're on the right track by creating an awareness and to do programs like this, because civility is so important, and it's the glue that holds our society together.
And Letitia, there you were in the Kennedy White House. Now here we are, 2005. George W. Bush is in the White House. There's a resurgence of interest in manners. You heard our caller from Vermont, how horrified she was to see a fat man in shorts headed to Ronald Reagan's final viewing. But is there some link between the rise in American political conservatism and this apparent resurgence of interest in manners, even etiquette?
Well, I wish there was this resurgence you keep talking about, because the interest is there, but the practice of it in our civilization isn't showing up very much. If you talk about the rather obese man in shorts, look who's going to church. Forget going to view Ronald Reagan's body. Going to church and to temple. Look at the way they're dressed.
But is God less pleased to see the figure of man or woman without the three-piece suit?
Oh, listen, the three-piece suit is not at all what we're talking about. If somebody goes to work clean, freshly pressed, washed, of course, the way men go bearded, you never know whether they wash their face in the last 3 months or not, because they all look like thugs. Excuse me. I was stopped one day by a young person who said, "Miss Baldridge, all this stuff about manners is just so old hat. It makes you out to be a dinosaur." And I was rather upset by being called a dinosaur. And then I said, "Listen, one of the most loved creatures in this world is Barney. Children have grown up on Barney, and they love that dinosaur. And I'm proud and pleased to be called a dinosaur."
But let me ask you something that Jacqueline raised earlier. She said, you know, in this period where we have many cultures at play in the United States at one time, and, of course, a whole world full of cultures outside that, is there really a standard of manners that cuts right across that? You've just put beards down, and, of course, there are many cultures, including Islamic cultures, where beards may even be required.
No, I'm talking about the 5 o'clock shadow.
The Hollywood cool guy thing.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
What's wrong with that? In Hollywood, maybe that's the highest form of style.
Well, if you're a girl with sensitive skin, to kiss a man with that kind of a 5 o'clock shadow is very disagreeable, and she may have to put stuff all over her face for days to protect it.
Now you raise a very, very reasonable point there. Let me take a caller. Donna is calling from Worcester, Massachusetts. Donna, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
A couple years ago, my family went down to Williamsburg for Christmas, and that consisted of my mother, who is in her late 70s, my brother and his wife, my sister, and her sons, who were in their late teens and early 20s.
Okay, in Williamsburg, a very proper setting.
Right,
yes.
And I was buying dinner. Mm-hmm. I had arranged for us to have a private dining room in one of the noted taverns. And, of course, they provide servers and, you know, and we had musicians that came in and played.
All sounds perfect, but something ruined your dinner. What?
The servers come in, and they were supposed to be serving. I mean, this is family-style vegetables, but they're going to hold them, and you're going to put them, you know, on your plate.
All right.
My sister-in-law promptly dismisses them. I bite my tongue. This is their job. This is what they're there for. That's
right.
Why I'm paying big bucks for this dinner.
But she says scram, and it just goes downhill. What happened?
Then, later on, she's talking, and she's deciding my sister-in-law is in her early 40s. She's deciding that she can put a spoon on her nose longer than anybody else. This dinner ran me over $700, and my sister-in-law puts a spoon on her nose.
Shock, dismay.
I was ripped, and I didn't really quite...
But is she a clown, or are you too uptight?
Well, my sister would call me too uptight, but I'm sitting here going, you don't do this at the dinner table.
Please.
I don't care if you're eating at home.
And I'm paying, and that's enough
and
of that.
You
thank
know,
you.
And I'm paying, and paying over $700 for a dinner, and my sister-in-law is deciding that she's going to put a spoon on her nose.
All right, let us get this adjudicated, Donna. Our time is short before the break. Letitia, we've got some frivolity and some fury.
I would banish my sister-in-law and have lunch or dinner with her only at a fast food joint. She was not showing you respect for your invitation for your party. Hey, we all have to have certain responsibilities. Guests are supposed to be nice and talk and help the conversation be good and not have it dirty or have people erupt in rage. All of those things we have to pull together and have a little self-control. But I think to be a clown at somebody's dinner is not very nice. Frankly, it's not in the spirit of civility and good manners.
Jacqueline, what marks for the sister-in-law? We just got 20 seconds before the break, but where do you grade her?
Well, I have a couple thoughts. I wouldn't invite her anymore if I had a choice. But more importantly, I think that we sometimes have to overlook some of these flaws, because if you tell a friend or a family member their social faults, they'll cure the fault and never forgive you.
And that will be the end of that. It all depends on what we're valuing here. Jacqueline Whitmore, Letitia Baldridge, Jack, please stand by. We're talking about manners, about etiquette. What do you think? Is a well-mannered society liberating, more gracious and kind? Or is etiquette itself a kind of genteel tyranny? 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, BICON.com, and Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital, for more than 60 years helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services, in Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about manners, about etiquette, and Americans newly interested in buffing up their behavior. We're joined by Letitia Baldridge, former social secretary to Jackie Kennedy, author of New Manners for New Times, by Jacqueline Whitmore, author of Business Class, Etiquette Essentials for Success at Work. You can join us as well, 1-800-423-8255. Jason is calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Jason. You're on the air.
I guess I'm probably going to be in the minority here. I'm kind of of the opinion that etiquette is less liberating and, I guess, more about genteel tyranny, as you put it right before the break.
A Nashville call? A Southerner, maybe? Against manners, can it be?
Originally from the West Coast, spent some time in the East Coast, so I have some exposure to somewhat genteel areas of the U.S.
And why do you say that they're oppressive, not liberating?
Well, I mean, it seems to me that table manners, which you spoke about earlier in the mm-hmm. show, is a perfect example. One of your speakers was saying that there was that line about those people who were making $400,000 or $500,000 a year and yet stabbing their meat like a wild beast. And so the people who don't have table manners they're kind of seen as not fully human. And it turns out that the people who have table manners are the people who tend to grow up in situations where there is money and where there is plenty of time to learn these table manners. And the people that don't have them tend to come from working class, lower class backgrounds.
But is it possible that in recent decades, right across social or economic backgrounds, Americans have let go of manners, even at a essential degree that is kind of unsettling? Do you ever find that, Jason?
It depends, I guess, on what you call manners. I guess there was this distinction made earlier between civility and then other forms of manners.
I guess I think of it as kindness, as considerateness, really.
Yeah, you can learn kindness, but it's not clear to me that knowing what fork to use at the dinner table is an indication of how kind you are as a person.
Jason, we've got it, and we appreciate your call. I want to bring a voice in right now from New York. Joseph Fernandez joins us. He is a graduate of Jacqueline Whitmore's Etiquette School. He's currently a student at New York University. Joseph, thanks for being with us.
Hey, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Why did you go? What did you learn?
I originally met Jacqueline last winter. I was introduced to her through a very supportive aunt of mine who suggested that I meet with her and work with her since she knew that I had interest in doing international business, international relations.
Did your aunt think you had some issues to work out on the manners front,
No,
Joseph?
It wasn't particularly that. It was just that she thought that I could benefit strongly by at least, being prepared, since I'm young right now, starting early at the bottom of the ladder, being prepared for what's to come in the business world.
How old are you, Joseph?
I'm 20 years old.
And did you feel ignorant of what good manners were?
Not particularly. I knew, going to, a very fancy dining place, maybe I wouldn't know exactly in the beginning what silverware to use and when or how to use them.
But now do you feel empowered or?
Yeah, well, basically what came of meeting with Jacqueline Whitmore, because she specializes in, business etiquette,
right.
International protocol, it gave me a lot of confidence when either, you're working with presenting your resume, conducting an interview, while confidence when you're socializing, networking.
Is it working for you? Can you tell? Are people responding to you differently?
It is, actually. I've already started to use and implement the things that I've worked on with Jacqueline. Actually, this summer, I'm working at Northwestern Mutual Financial Network, and it's considered a prestigious, you know, internship for college agents.
Yeah.
And when I went through the process to get the job, I used some of the, you know, strategy that I'd done with Jacqueline.
You got your handshake down?
Yeah, I got the handshake down.
Boy, it sounds simple.
Yeah, just some of, like, the formalities, too, of after you're doing the interview, having, yeah, you know, personalized stationery and sending a follow-up thank you letter showing you're sincerely interested to kind of get you to stand out from the rest who might have been, you know, just as qualified but didn't put in that extra effort.
Oh, boy, it's so. Back to the Future, and we hear it, but we hear your genuine interest in this, and it sounds like it's working for you. Joseph Fernandez, thank you very much for being with
us. Thank you very much.
We heard earlier in this hour that technology may have had a role in eroding manners and eroding American etiquette. I want to look into that with Judith Kalos. She joins us from Lincolnshire, Illinois. She's author of Because Netiquette Matters. She's an internet consultant, web designer. Her website is netmanners.com. Judith, thanks for being with us.
Hey, Tom. Good to be with you.
So we hear this not infrequently, that email and the web have made us a less polite, less considerate, more rude society. Is that why you exist? Is it true?
Well, you know what? I think it's really interesting. If you listen to what all your fine guests said before me, if it doesn't exist offline, how are people going to know how to behave online with a technology that pretty much has only been here for a decade, and they're supposed to all of a sudden know how to have manners online by osmosis?
But haven't the age of flaming and online rudeness diminished? I mean, I hear a lot about etiquette required at certain sites online, of people being kicked out of websites because they're not being gracious. They're not following the rules.
Well, you know, that's sort of the latest up-and-coming thing. As you're mentioning, you know, it seems to be netiquette, which is network etiquette, seems to be gaining steam. I've been online for 12 years. I've been doing the netmanners.com for 8. And probably only in the last 2 years am I getting support and seeing that educators are now, because how can educators teach children how to use technology properly if they don't know?
So is the web going to stay the Wild West of manners, or is it becoming a civilizing force?
Yeah, I think it's getting better. There's a long way to go. There's a long way to go. And it's got to start from the bottom up, from teaching, you know, youngsters how to use it. A lot of parents don't even know how. One of the things I've run into in my consulting practice for the past decade is a shocking lack of desire to acquire new knowledge. And if people don't want to learn how to use technology properly, my tagline is using technology effectively to communicate with others, both personally and professionally, with knowledge, understanding, and courtesy.
What could be better? I'm going to have to be rude. Our time is short. Judith Kalos, you're very good to join us, and we're grateful to you. Let
Thanks.
Me get one more call here. George is calling from Boston. Hi, George. You're on the air.
Thank you. Hi.
Hi.
I wanted to say that it seems to me that things like which fork to use, et cetera, is merely ideas of breeding, things like that, etiquette. But it takes no schooling or training or upbringing at all to realize that if you're able-bodied, you should, for example, give up your seat to the obviously pregnant or elderly woman on the subway.
Basic courtesy.
Yes, and without that, we're
We're
going nowhere.
So go for courtesy overall. George, I'm rude again, but our time is so short. I've just got a couple of minutes left here. Jacqueline Whitmore, quick, with your etiquiz. In the business arena, A, only men should stand for handshaking in all introductions. Only women should stand. Women don't have to stand. Okay, in the business arena, who stands for handshaking in introductions? Everyone?
Remember, the business arena is gender neutral, so men and women should stand because it shows respect for the other person, but more importantly, it shows respect for yourself.
And the quiz goes right on. A lot to learn there, but you'd like to think that some of it would come naturally to people. Letitia Baldridge, don't manners come naturally to people at some level, a sense of what's considerate, what's kind, which is, after all, the bottom line, isn't it?
It is the bottom line, but they don't come naturally. It has to be taught. It has to be learned. Children have to observe and come to the conclusion that something is kind or unkind, and that their own life is going to be much better if they show those manners. It just is what makes the world go round, and it's human relations, and forget about which fork to use. We're getting to the point where we're going to be all eating with our fingers pretty soon anyway.
Oh, boy, going from bad to worse. But you two are out there educating the world, and we're grateful to you for spending some time with us today. Letitia Baldridge, former social secretary to Jackie Kennedy, author of New Manners for New Times, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Jacqueline Whitmore, author of Business Class, Etiquette Essentials for Success at Work. Jacqueline, thanks for being here.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
So, Jack, where does this leave you, my friend? We've got this big, sprawling, wonderful, multicultural society. We can see rudeness on many fronts and yet kindness on many fronts. If we up the etiquette factor, the manners factor, does it work together better, or is there a common set of manners anymore?
That's what I worry about, whether they're, you know, we can say that, partly because of cultural relativity. People in different cultures are more expressive than others, partly because people just don't know what the rules are, and partly because the cues we get, the surround in life is so consistently rude. I mean, look at ads on TV. It's all about putting other people down. That's not a school for manners.
Well, it is a generational thing, interestingly. I can still hear the voices of my grandparents, not demanding, but just modeling in my mind simple decency. That you've got to vote for.
Indeed.
Jack, thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you, sir.
And you, my good man. Listeners, you, our dear listeners, can continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, these boys always look good in tuxedos, if you don't mind the webbed feet. This is On Point. Imagine walking a distance equal to almost three full marathons, nonstop, 70 miles. No big deal? Okay, imagine doing it if you're only 3 feet tall, waddling on webbed feet, battling the Antarctic winter, and doing it all dressed in natural formal wear.
There is a mysterious ritual that dates back thousands of years. No living creature has survived it, except the penguin.
The Emperor Penguin, to be exact, and the stars of the box office smash documentary March of the Penguins, a French film team spent a year living with the birds in the coldest place on Earth. Their movie, narrated by Morgan Freeman, you heard him there, is the surprise hit of the summer and the second highest grossing documentary film of all time, right behind Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11. Joining us now from Paris is Luc Jacquet, director of March of the Penguins. Monsieur Jacquet, welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. What took you to Antarctica to focus on penguins for so much time?
I think if you go to Antarctica for one time, you must want to go again and again, because it's really amazing place, and this crazy and amazing creature, the Emperor Penguin, I mean, is really, you must be touched, and you need. And I was so touched and so impressed that I make this film.
It's a film about birds, quite remarkable birds, but nevertheless, it's been such a smash hit, $56 million gross already. What do you think it is that has people responding with such a box office fervor for the film?
I'm very touched, and I'm very impressed, because, you know, at the beginning, this film was a very, very small film, and now the audience is so huge, and, you know, I don't really know. Of course, the penguin is cute. Of course, the Antarctic is an amazing place. Of course, the story is very strong, but, you know, there is something magic when the audience is so big. So I don't really know, but once again, I'm very proud.
People look at these emperor penguins, and they look so regal with their black and white coloring and that erect posture. Are these well-mannered birds when you get to know them as intimately as you did?
Yes, we can say that, yeah.
Meaning they don't fuss, they don't fight? You lived with them for a year. They must have their tussles, too.
You know, they are like... They look to be like they know exactly what they have to do, and they do the same behavior all the time, and it's crazy how they are motivated to do all the things. And really, it's an amazing scenery to see them in these kind of landscapes.
What was it like to be human in their environment, so close to them? Were you able to get right next to them? Did they accept you in the midst?
Yes, they accept them. But you know, when you are human in Antarctica, you feel very weak. You know, we are not made to live in there. But emperor penguins are really made to live there. And you know, I'm very impressed all the time. I go there and I can live in the surrounding of the penguins colony. I say, but how can do survive in such environment? You know, after 2 or 3 hours in the middle of the winter, you are frozen. You know, you have to go in the building and eat something very warm to get better. And they stay all the days and all the night on the ice, simply on the ice. And trust me, it's crazy.
You had to fly and ski and hike deep into penguin territory to get next to them. How do the emperor penguins get around? We heard about the long walks they make in the introduction. Are they big swimmers as well?
Yes, they are swimmers. They are, first of all, the emperor penguin is a really fantastic oceanic creature. And we can ask why do they have to walk one day in their story. You know, it's mm-hmm. very strange, because they are so the ocean is their really place, you know, where they can live easily. After that, they have to fight again and again against the winter.
And is there a character to emperor penguins as a whole, on the whole, or did you get to know individual characters of these birds? Could you make that kind of distinction?
No, it's very odd, because, you know, for us, all the penguins are quite the same. For them, it's very different, because they know exactly who are who in the colony, but for us, they are all the same.
Meaning,
unfortunately,
there's a strict pecking order among penguins?
I'm sorry?
There's a pecking order, a hierarchy among penguins?
I don't know.
your emotions as you sat with the birds all this time, do you project them onto the birds, or do you see them as cold birds in a cold place?
For me, they are much more than birds, you know, much more than birds. They are, yes, like, they are more noble. It's a very, very... It's a special creature. It's much more than birds again.
Your opening narration line says, "This is a story about love." Now, we know you're French, but what's the love story among the emperor penguins?
Why do you say, because I'm French?
Oh, you know, it's the old line, just for fun.
No, more than love, I want to say that they need to be so close and to have so strong links between the male and the female to breed the chick, to stay alive. And for me, it's like love for human. Love, it's really human world, you know. But we can describe this behavior like love, because they are so amazingly close, you know.
Emperor Penguin Love, and a big smash hit with March of the Penguins. Luc Jacquet is director. Mr. Jacquet, thanks for joining us.
Merci beaucoup. Thank you for us. Bye-bye.
Director of March of the Penguins. He spoke with us from Paris. For more information on the movie and the Emperor Penguin, go to our website, onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Eileen Amada, Stefano Katsonis, Matt Lieber, James Ross, Christina Russo, and Karen Schiffman. With help from Mike Toda, John Berger, and Angel Coselli, our senior producer is Joe O'Connor. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.